I too would like to start, Mark, and the department for inviting me along. This is obviously a lot of experts in the field of commodities and commodity pricing. And my role, I guess, is to take a step back and think about how this all fits into thinking about commodities in the macroeconomy for Australia. So the terms of trade will always be an important part of the macroeconomic landscape for a small open economy such as Australia. And as we've already seen from a number of graphs since the 2000s, it's been particularly important because of the size of the terms of trade cycle. As you can imagine, at the Reserve Bank of Australia, we've spent a lot of time thinking about how to forecast the terms of trade and what the implications of the terms of trade are for the macroeconomy. And that's pretty much the topic that I've been given to talk about today. So I'll focus on two questions. The first one is, how good are we at forecasting the terms of trade? And the second one is, based on recent experience, what parts of the domestic economy are most likely to be affected by changes in the terms of trade? So starting with the first question of how good are we at forecasting the terms of trade, the simple answer to that question is not very. So this graph has a picture of the actual terms of trade and RBA forecasts at various points in time. The answer not very shouldn't be particularly surprising because macroeconomic forecasting is a very difficult thing to do. The bank acknowledges this in its publication of forecasts on a quarterly basis in the statement on monetary policy by putting confidence intervals around our forecasts for GDP growth, the unemployment rate, and underlying inflation. Arguably, forecasting the terms of trade is even more difficult because of the size of the structural changes that have been occurring. In terms of structural changes, we've had the unprecedented nature of the emergence of the Chinese economy and demand for commodities. And there's also quite a bit of uncertainty about the supply of commodities in responding to that. How long was it going to take for investment to take place and to translate into production of commodities? So at the risk of simplifying the question of forecast or how do we forecast the terms of trade, the answer is that it's roughly equivalent to forecasting commodity prices. So you can see from this graph there's a pretty strong correlation between various measures of commodity prices and the terms of trade. A large part of the misses that we made in the upswing phase of the terms of trade was an underappreciation of quite what was happening in China and how much demand was growing from emerging markets. After a long period of low commodity prices, there'd been very little investment in infrastructure, so there really wasn't enough production capacity to meet this increase in demand, and prices increased. As a result of that, we had a substantial increase in mining investment in Australia and in a number of other countries around the world. So just to give you an idea of the magnitude of that, in the early 2000s, mining investment represented about 2% of GDP. And by the time we got to 2012, which was the peak of mining investment, it represented about 8% of GDP. But as I already mentioned, it takes a while for investment to translate into production. And for a considerable period of time, the supply or increase in supply really didn't keep up with the increase in demand, and commodity prices continued to increase. Over the past couple of years, we've seen a huge increase in the ramp up of supply, and it's been the case that supply has in fact more than kept up with demand, and commodity prices have been falling. Over the past year or so, there's been a distinct slowing in global demand for commodities as well. So that's also been a contributor to the fall in commodity prices we've seen more recently. As we've discussed in the statement on monetary policy, which I'm sure you all read on a regular basis, there's considerable uncertainty about the forces of supply and demand underlying the terms of trade and commodities at this point in time. And that leads to a fair bit of uncertainty about our terms of trade forecasts. So what we do at the bank to try and get a better understanding of what is sitting underneath or what could be affecting the terms of trade, we monitor international developments in economies, particularly China, to try and understand how demand might be evolving. On the supply side, we have a regional liaison program where we extensively discuss issues in the mining sector and how the mining sector sees its prospects. So that's sort of a direct liaison that we do. We also use information on international production costs. We saw some graphs of the production or the cost curves, and we use that primarily to inform our forecasts of bulk commodity prices. Another source of insight, and I would be very remiss in not mentioning the Department of Industry, Innovation and Science, so they also produce projections of prices and volumes for the bulk commodities and LNG. And so that's another useful cross-check for us when we're going through our data to understand how you guys are interpreting similar sorts of information, but it's always useful to look at things from more than one side. Another important source of information is financial market prices. So at least in theory, spot financial prices really should contain all the information that's available on supply and demand, as long as the financial markets are reasonably deep and liquid. So once we get to things like the rare earth commodities that we're talking about, there are no financial market prices to help us. But for a number of commodities, there are financial markets. If we think that the spot price of gives us a good indication of supply and demand, or captures all the information on supply and demand, the best thing that you can really do in terms of forecasting is make an assumption of no change. If you look at the theory of commodity markets, however, there are a number of special factors that suggest it's not just going to be the spot market information, it's also going to be futures prices that provide you with some sort of idea about current and future supply and demand conditions. So we've been doing quite a bit of analysis at the bank to try and understand what information we can get from spot and futures markets. And it does suggest that there are quite a few commodities for which you can't really do a lot better than a no-change assumption from the current spot price. But there are other cases where futures prices do seem to do quite a good job of giving you additional information. And interestingly, some of those examples are things that are particularly important to us. So that would be iron ore and oil, for example. The development of the iron ore futures market is relatively recent. So that's something that we've sort of over the past couple of years started to look at more carefully. But when you turn to oil futures markets, they've actually been some of the deepest and most liquid commodity markets for some time. And there's been a lot of academic literature asking the question, what information is there in these prices? And that's particularly interesting because as the production of LNG ramps up, and obviously a lot of people in this room will know more about the details of that than I will, the projections for oil prices are going to become increasingly important for our forecasts of the terms of trade because LNG prices, at least at this point in time, are very closely linked to oil prices, albeit with a lag of one or two quarters. So I'll now turn to the question of how do the terms of trade affect the domestic economy. I've already mentioned this, but one of the most obvious consequences of a significant pickup in commodity prices has been the increase in mining investment. The increase in mining investment has led to an increase in production capacity, and that's led to a huge increase in the growth of resource exports. So in each of the past 3 years, resource exports have contributed around 1 percentage point to GDP growth. And that's compared to roughly one third of that in the decade leading up to 2012. The increase in resource exports has gone a really long way to offsetting the drag to domestic growth that has come from the decline in mining investment that we've seen since 2012. The reallocation of capital and labour to the mining sector was facilitated by a number of very large or significant changes in relative prices. One of the most important relative price shifts was the appreciation of the Australian dollar that accompanied the rise in the terms of trade. One consequence of this was that non-mining firms that were in the business of producing traded goods and services became internationally less competitive, and so their demand for capital and labour was less than it would otherwise have been. Another direct consequence of higher commodity prices was that national income was able to grow faster than domestic production from around 2003 to 2012. This allowed the mining sector to attract labour from other sectors of the economy by offering relatively high wages. Indeed, as the mining investment boom proceeded, wage growth in the mining sector picked up, and there was clear evidence that wage growth picked up in other parts of the economy. This was either because other parts of the economy were directly benefiting from an increase in demand for their goods and services coming from the mining sector, but it was also the case that a number of other sectors increased their wages to try and attract or even retain staff they already had. The unemployment rate fell to levels that we haven't seen in Australia since the 1960s and early 1970s. Some of the increase in the demand for labour was accommodated through faster growth in working age population, particularly in Western Australia and Queensland. Some of this was the result of migration from other states, but it was also the result of an increase in net immigration from other countries. The appreciation of the exchange rate also helped to distribute the increase in income from the higher terms of trade by reducing the cost of imported goods. This benefited most households. So most households, it's pretty easy to see what sorts of things they buy, their imports. And this has the effect of increasing their real incomes. It's also true for businesses that import a significant share of their imports. No, import a significant share of their inputs. So some of the income gains were also distributed more widely throughout the economy by the federal government because they effectively received more tax income as a result of the mining boom. We've got estimates based on bank research that uses the AusM model of the Australian economy, which suggests that household disposable income was around 13% higher in 2013 than it would have been had commodity prices not increased and there hadn't been an associated boom in the mining industry. Over this period, consumption grew more slowly than income, and we saw an increase in the household saving ratio. Although the global financial crisis is likely to have accounted for some of the increase in the saving ratio around 2008 and 2009, one interpretation of this sort of longer run increase in the saving ratio is that households understood that some of this boost to the income, their real incomes that they were experiencing, were at least partly temporary. And so they saved some of this windfall gain, if you like, so that they could support consumption through the inevitable downturn in the terms of trade. So this interpretation is consistent with what we've seen recently, which is that the saving ratio has declined gradually from around 2012, which is the point in time where the terms of trade turned. Indeed, many of the adjustments that we saw in the economy as the terms of trade increased have started to go into reverse as the terms of trade have turned. The exchange rate has depreciated. So this has helped to improve the competitiveness of non-mining sectors that are involved in producing traded goods and services. The effect of this has probably been most notable for net service exports. These have been making a roughly similar contribution to GDP growth as resource exports recently. So these are things predominantly tourism and education. The labour market has also adjusted. Wage growth has been very low, and employment growth has been driven by service industries over the past year or so. The unemployment rate has been lower over the course of this year than we had forecast at the beginning of the year. Growth in working age population has also slowed, and this is primarily due to a fall in net immigration. This has been most pronounced in Western Australia and Queensland, which, as you would expect, have been most directly affected by the decline in mining investment and lower commodity prices. So this is a sort of basic taxonomy of how the macro economy of Australia has responded to the cycle in the terms of trade. And I thought I'd just wrap up my comments by talking a little bit about how this episode has compared with previous episodes of or previous terms of trade cycles or previous episodes of significant structural change in the economy. So while current growth in the Australian economy is not as strong as we would like. The evidence from previous terms of trade cycles suggests that we've actually done pretty well in aggregate. Although the unemployment rate has increased and there is clearly excess capacity in the labour market, it is not increased by as much as we would have expected based on the experience of previous episodes of significant structural change. Some of the explanation for this appears to be that the labour market has been more flexible. And relative wage developments have facilitated the adjustment of labour between sectors more effectively than it has done in the past. Unlike previous episodes, we did not experience a significant bout of inflation. This was partly because the exchange rate appreciation helped to buffer the economy. But it was also partly because inflation expectations seemed to stay reasonably anchored throughout the episode. This highlights the benefits of having a strong, credible macroeconomic policy framework and pursuing reforms that allow the economy to adapt and respond to changes in circumstances efficiently. So thank you very much. That's my summary, and I presume I move to questions next.
Questions next. Wonderful opportunity. Questions for Alex.
I'm outside their comfort zone.
What's the outlook?
Right. Well, the outlook for the labour market has actually been improving over the course of this year. So one of the things that, if you want more detail on this, we've talked about it in the statement on monetary policy. If you look at the sectors where the growth is occurring in terms of employment, it's actually the household services sector that's been steadily adding to employment over the last couple of years, and more recently business services. So I think this is a part of a longer-term structural change story. So the manufacturing industry in terms of employment has been in decline for some time. This is not a recent or new development. This has actually been going for some time, and I think it's a part of a process that will continue. But it's not as if other sectors of the economy aren't growing, and the opportunity to be employed in those sectors is actually pretty good. So in terms of our forecasts for employment and the unemployment rate, we actually see that the unemployment rate will probably stay in a sort of 6 to 6.25 range for a while. But as the momentum in growth picks up, we expect the unemployment rate to start falling. Big and booming enough.
Alex, I wonder if you might say a little bit about what the bank's thinking is around India, and how much effort you're putting into thinking about India in driving global economic growth. We know that its energy consumption per capita is very, very small. Its steel intensity is similar. To what extent does India represent a China Mark II, or do you downplaying that? I'm just curious to know what
you're thinking about
that area.
Sure. I can't remember exactly when, but we've actually recently, it's probably not that recent now, we actually have a team of people who focus very much on China and India. So the idea is that, there's an accompanying graph to the terms of trade graph that shows that what we didn't really appreciate was quite how fast China would grow. And I think it's quite clearly the case that one of the other economies that you need to pay a lot of attention to is India. There's a lot of potential for growth there, and there's a lot of potential as it evolves and opens out, because it's a relatively closed economy, and this is what happened with China, that they'll become a much more significant player, both in terms of demand for commodities. They're also a significant commodity producer, so there's the potential for them to be supplying commodities as well. So I guess the answer to your question is we put a lot of effort into trying to follow developments in India. At this point in time, it doesn't seem like over the next couple of years, which is the focus of our forecast horizon, that it's going to have a significant impact on the external demand conditions that we face, but we pay a lot of attention and keep alert to signs of things changing on that front.
There's one Peter Morris right from the Minerals Council of Australia. Thanks, Alex, for your presentation. Are you able to comment on any learnings from policy perspective over the past 15 years from when we've gone through the boom bust? I'm thinking, for example, of the role of government and competition policy, which has been a drag on investment, and also the growth in regulation.
I would actually say that the main policy lessons that we've learnt from the past 15 years was captured by one of the last comments that I made, which is that Australia has had previous episodes of significant structural change. The nature of that might have been different. We do have previous examples of significant terms of trade booms. But actually, the Australian economy has adapted better in this episode than perhaps we might have expected from previous episodes. So it seems that the labour market has been more responsive and more flexible in the way that it's adapted. Relative wages have been able to sort of redistribute labour across sectors more effectively than in previous episodes. If we're thinking about the terms of trade specifically, this is one of the first terms of... Well, it's one of the things that distinguishes this terms of trade boom from previous ones is that we've had a flexible exchange rate. And theory suggests that that should do a very good job of buffering the domestic economy. And I think that's the experience that we would come away... Or that's the lesson we would come away from the experience with, that a flexible exchange rate has served us very well. And as I mentioned, I think one of the things that we have also benefited from is a macroeconomic policy framework, so that monetary policy is one element of that that's very well articulated, it's been very well communicated, and that's really helped everybody anchor their expectations of how macroeconomic policy is going to respond to things as the situation develops, and that seems to also have served us well. So if you go back to previous terms of trade episodes, the fixed exchange rate and the way monetary policy was run basically meant that we had very, very significant inflation issues arising from the terms of trade and boom, and we haven't seen that this time around. So I think the main lessons are that some of the reforms that we've gone through and the policy frameworks that we've put a lot of effort into defining well and being very careful about have been very beneficial to us.
Tapas Strickland here from the National Australia Bank. You mentioned the RBA looks at commodity prices, and one commodity that international investors look at is the copper price, and that's recently been plumbing new lows. I was just wondering whether you could speak to its relationship with global demand and what you think is going on there.
Okay. Well, again, there's probably other people in the room who have views on this as well. So one of the interesting graphs from one of the previous presentations was the one that had the correlation between coal and oil prices. And I thought that was very interesting because at the beginning of this year, we actually had a situation where the oil price moved by a significant amount, and we had to make a decision from a forecasting perspective about how we would think that would affect the terms of trade. And as the graph that was presented shows, there's actually historically quite a strong correlation between oil prices and coal prices, for example, or other energy products. So Australia is in a slightly interesting situation in that we're actually a net oil importer, but we're a net energy exporter. So if we thought that the fall in oil prices was automatically going to flow through to the fall in coal prices, that actually had quite different implications for the terms of trade than if we thought it wouldn't. And so my point in here is we had to think very carefully about whether we thought what was driving oil prices was a demand shock, in which case you would expect it to be increase the correlation of commodity prices. So if you have a generalised increase in demand for energy and commodities, you would expect that to affect all commodities. Is it a localised demand shock? That seems unlikely with oil. Or was it a supply shock? So our assessment at the time was that a large part of the story about why oil prices were falling was connected to the increase in supply of oil, unconventional oil from the US more specifically. So we felt that that was an example where there wasn't going to be an automatic translation of the fall in oil prices to coal prices. As I alluded to, every commodity has its own sort of supply story, and that's sort of one of the benefits of having the sorts of research that comes out of the department is to try and understand what those particular things are. Our general assessment is that over the past year, the demand element of behind it is a stronger force in explaining why commodity prices have been lower, and we've seen a much stronger correlation across commodity prices. So that's a long way of saying, I think, movements in base metals or falls in base metals are probably telling us a similar story, that there is a significant demand element. And it's very difficult not to look at the situation in China and look at the development of industrial production, for example, and not think that there has been a slowing in demand for industrial products, and that includes a whole range of base metals. That includes iron ore and coal. Person behind a poll.
You mentioned that Australia is managing the transition through the resources boom pretty well, and then employment growth has been quite strong. But at the same time, GDP growth has been a bit more tepid. What are your thoughts on the kind of divergence between the two, and how can that be explained?
So if you go to the beginning of this year, so the forecast that we produced in the Statement of Monetary Policy in the beginning of the year, we very much had a view that if growth was going to be below trend, then it was likely that the unemployment rate would gradually increase. Over the course of the year, we've revised our view of how these things fit together, partly because the information coming from the labour force kept saying, well, actually, employment growth has been pretty reasonable, and recently you'd almost go so far as to say it's been pretty strong. The unemployment rate wasn't increasing. It was sort of staying in a band of sort of 6.25. So there's a number of ways to reconcile those two things. One is that we've had relatively low wage growth, so that's in some sense enabled service industries that have got demand to increase their employment to meet that demand. So this is a part of the story about the flexible labour market in operation. Another part of the story is just the sectoral story, that if you look at where the growth is, and there's a whole range of indicators that you can look at, the labour market is one. You can look at business conditions, investment intentions, and things like capacity utilisation measures from surveys, and these are all saying that the growth in the economy is coming from household services predominantly, but also business services to an extent as well. And so it's just a part of the story of this handover process. We're undergoing a process of structural change. We're handing over from mining. It's being picked up in services. That process takes a bit of time to move labour, and that also goes some way to reconciling those two pieces of information. And pretty much, if you look at the forecasts, we're expecting that growth will start to pick up from here, that the economy will continue with this momentum, and that all the pieces will align